it's great to be with you, and you're probably wondering how is that reading going to relate to talking with Muslims, but I'll see if I can pull that all together. So as we mentioned before, I have two hats. I am a mission partner with InterServe, so I've been with them for about 30 years, involved in all of those different countries in outreach to Muslims. My background's teaching. My wife's a doctor, and so we went there with our medical and teaching professions. We're involved there and looking for opportunities to share the good news with Muslim people. And then since back in Australia, I'm now lecturing at Melbourne School of Theology. We have a department there which focuses specifically on Islam. I think the only one in Australia that does that, and there's three, four of us in the department. I'm going to ask you to do something very strange today. You know how you're normally told to switch off your phone? I'm going to ask you to switch it on. And this means you can text me questions at any time. So my number will be up on every screen, and you can text those to me. I do this for a couple of reasons. Sometimes you're sitting there in a sermon and you think, oh, I'd really like to ask that question, and by the end of the sermon, it's gone. Well, you can text it to me straight away, and it will come up on my phone. I won't answer it straight away. I'll stop at different times to do that. The other advantage is if you don't like what I'm saying, you can just pull your phone out and just be searching the net, and you can send some emails to friends and whatever, and people think you're being really spiritual. So so that's multi-purpose. Any questions I don't pick up in this, I'll pick up in the Faith Effect session afterwards. We have a sign-up sheet. In fact, I actually forgot to bring the sign-up sheet, but if afterwards you're interested in being put on our mailing list to be told about ministry to Muslims and some training opportunities and ministry opportunities, you can come and chat. I'll have a group of my students out at the book table afterwards, and maybe you can just give them their details, or you can text those to me. So our topic today is understanding and responding to Islam. How do we think about Islam, and particularly how do we respond to it as Christians? I think there's a way that many people in Australia respond to it, but I think as Christians we need to have a distinctive kind of response. And it comes a little bit about, well, how do you think about Islam? If you ask for an image, people might go, well, this guy, Jihadi John, the British guy who was with ISIS, possibly being killed in an airstrike, but famous for cutting people's heads off on YouTube. Or you might think of this little fellow, Aylan Kurdi. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel said when she saw this this picture, her heart broke, and so she opened the door, and so a million refugees from Syria and other places came into Germany as a result of this little fellow fleeing from Syria and drowned, and his body was found on a beach in Turkey. Or you might think of this guy, or these two guys, Walid Ali, the man about town and famous TV star, but also a serious academic. He's got his doctorate now. Or Usman Khawaja, who was head of the Australian cricket team that was going to play before one of the matches got cancelled. So you've got Australians in quite prominent positions. You may not know about this young lady, Sabrina Houssami, who was Miss Australia in 2006, a Muslim lady. And they said, what's a Muslim girl doing wearing a bikini in front of people? And she said, Islam is about charity, and the Miss Australia contest raises money for charity. So she justified it for that reason. So if you take away nothing from today, just think of Islam is not a monolith. It is a spectrum. There's this incredible range of different people within Islam. So when you meet a Muslim, don't stereotype them. Think of them as a human being with a history and all of the whole other things. And they'll often quite differ a lot with each other, as we'll see later on. The world today, we've got about 1.8 billion, about 24% of the world's population. And as I mentioned before, about 600,000 in Australia, 2.6%. In the last census, it became Australia's second largest religion. Previously, it was behind Buddhism, but it's grown in the last 5 years. Still a small slither of the Australian population, but there's enough of them around that you can see them on the streets as you walk around. Let's go through a quick rundown. I'm assuming you know nothing about Islam. So it began in 570 AD in the town of Mecca in Saudi Arabia with the birth of a man named Muhammad. And what's really important about him is that his DNA is in Islam. So what you see in Islam is has come from the life of Muhammad. The Quran tells us that you have a good pattern in God's messenger. So Muhammad is seen as the best example of a human being that has ever lived, according to Islam. They're told whatever he gives you, take it, whatever he forbids you, abstain from it, and whoever obeys the messenger has obeyed Allah. So you can see the significance of this man. It's very important. But there's two faces to Muhammad. When he started preaching in Mecca at age 40, it's about 610 AD, he went to the people of Mecca who were all idolaters. The black box, the Kaaba in the middle of Mecca, had about 360 idols in there. It's a bit like the Arab version of the Greek pantheon. And Muhammad started preaching against these idols, saying you shouldn't be bowing down to bits of wood and stone. There's only one God who lives in heaven, and you need to live righteous lives. And in this time, he sounded a bit like the Old Testament prophets. If you read it through, you think, oh, this could be Jeremiah or Isaiah or Ezekiel. And his teaching about persecution was interesting. There was a big backlash from the people of Mecca. They didn't like this guy because the idols was what brought people into their town. It was a market town, but also a worship town. And we said, if we get rid of the idols, that's not going to be good for us. And so they started persecuting his followers. Some of them were tortured, some were put to death. And Muhammad's teaching during this period was very interesting. He says to them, to his followers, hold on to forgiveness, command what is right, turn away from the ignorant. Tell those who believe to forgive those who do not look forward to the days of Allah. He tells them, paradise is for those who repress anger and pardon men. Don't let others' hatred for you make you swerve to do wrong. Return evil with good. So this was the message in these first 12 years when he's preaching in Mecca. Sounds a little bit like the Sermon on the Mount. You know, you don't retaliate, but rather you forgive. Well, Muhammad wasn't happy in Mecca. There was a plot to take his life. And so in 622, he's now 52 years old. He's been preaching for 12 years in Mecca. He's got about 200 followers. So it hasn't been a very successful movement. They moved to Medina, a place which was previously called Yathrib, about 320 kilometres to the north, and they established the first Muslim city. And this is actually where Muslims say is the birth date of Islam. It began not from his birth, not from the beginning of his preaching, but when Islam was established as a political entity. And there Muhammad changed, this incredible change. He then became a militant warlord, and he began a reign of terror. Over the next 10 years until his death in 632, he led 27 military campaigns, sent his followers out on another 50. Anybody who criticised Muhammad, wrote poetry against him, he sent out death squads to kill them. They beheaded prisoners of war. A Jewish man who had hidden some treasure was burnt alive. Whole towns were enslaved. Muhammad then went on, he had been faithful to his one wife for 25 years, she died, and then he married 10, some say 15, some say 20 more women. Amongst those was a little girl, 6 years old, and consummated the marriage at 9. His reign of terror brought him great wealth and power. The people of Arabia were kind of horrified at what was going on. They didn't know where he was going to strike next, so they started coming to Islam, converting to Islam in great numbers. But it was at the cost of thousands of lives. And he justified this by more verses that he received from Allah through the angel Gabriel. This famous one, the verse of the sword, kill the unbelievers wherever you find them and capture them and besiege them. And as you read through the Quran, you see there's about 412 verses. I'm a maths teacher, so I count that stuff, go through. So you've got the 45 peaceful verses here, but nearly 10 times as many violent verses. And that's where the kind of the weight of the scripture operates. And they also have this concept within Islam called abrogation, that if you have an earlier verse and a later verse comes to contradict it, you cancel out the first one. That no longer applies. And so that's how Islamic interpretation typically happens. Well, Muhammad died in 632, and by the end of his life, he ruled over the whole of the Arabian Peninsula. He was very successful as a political and a military ruler. He brought people under his control. And by that time, there were 100,000 followers. So it was just a snowballing movement that continued to take town after town, tribe after tribe, and people all committing themselves to Islam. People want to know more about where they can find out more about Muhammad. So I was prevailed upon to write a book. It was actually shortlisted for Christian Book of the Year last year. In fact, I was here in this building for that, and we've got copies of that. That's an easy introduction into the life of Muhammad, but also a good introduction if you want to know how to share Jesus with Muslims from a Christian perspective. So you get the two sides there, and a couple of other books there as well. If people have got questions, I don't think I've seen any that come through. You're a very quiet audience. Yeah, look at that. Oh, no, I've got some. Let's just see. Okay, some people are asking for copies of the talk. If you send me an email, I'll send you a copy of this with all the slides so you don't have to keep up with all the information that's going on. So when Muhammad dies, his followers say, well, which Muhammad are we going to follow? We've got two choices. We've got the peaceful Muhammad in Mecca for 12 years, or we've got the warlord in Medina for 10 years. The warlord was more successful. Let's just keep it going. And they did. You see, within 20 years, they had burst out of the Arabian Peninsula and occupied all of the Levant, the places like Syria and Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Iraq, Iran, parts of Turkey, Egypt, Sudan, Libya. Incredible move. This was only in 20 years. It was just a juggernaut. There was no way this thing could appear to be stopped. within 100 years, they had occupied two-thirds of Christendom. This was bigger than the empire of the Romans, bigger than the empire of Alexander the Great. Actually, not at this stage, but it grew to be bigger than those. By 1500 AD, they were the largest empire that the world had ever known. And you can see they've now pushed into Southeast Asia, down the east coast of Africa. These ones were not all by military expansion. There were traders and missionaries that were sent to these places, but around the Middle East, it was all through military expansion. So Islam's now become an international movement, but then there's some problems that start to arise. There was lack of education. This was because they had this kind of military expansionist view. That was never something, scholarship was never something that was highly prized in general. It happened at the higher levels. There was widespread corruption, as even soon after Muhammad's death, as soon as people got control of cities, they started taking the wealth of the cities, they put their friends and relatives in positions of power, then they all started fighting with each other. There was infighting. The Sunni, the Shia movement had started almost straight after the death of Muhammad. And so we've got all of these things, and then colonialism. Not only Western colonialism, which occupied about 90% of Muslim countries, but also Islamic colonialism. The Ottomans were one of the earliest and the biggest colonisers. They ruled for about 1,000 years. But all of these things conspired together to make Islam poor and oppressed. They really kind of fell down to the bottom of the world's pile. So I talked a little bit about how Muslims differ from each other. You find within Islam there's a pure traditional orthodox stream of Islam, but there's also what we call folk Islam, which picks up elements of folk religion, shamanism and animism. The Islam that gets the international news, so I see in London just the other day, another attack. Fundamentalist or violent Islam picks up the military aspects and Marxist kind of ideology. You've got liberal Islam, where our mission team during this week, we're going to visit people from the group called Muslims for Progressive Values, which is trying to get the first gay mosque here in Australia established. It will be happening here in Melbourne. So very kind of, they're very secular, modernist, feminist in terms of their thinking. And then Sufi Islam. Last night we went out to a meeting in Essendon. It was like a Pentecostal Muslim meeting. I call it Muhammad Goes to Planet Shakers. They were just up there and singing and dancing and raising their hands, and yeah, it was all in Arabic, but it was this really quite different from the Orthodox Islam. They meet in a church because no mosque in Melbourne will allow them to meet there. So you've got all of these different kinds of streams within Islam, and it can be really quite confusing. So the question that we want to have a look at is, how would Jesus respond to Islam today? What would he do to respond? I've got a couple of questions that I've got here. I don't censor my questions, so whatever comes up here on the screen, I read them out as they are. So this one here, so was Muhammad effectively a pedophile? I don't use that word because it's a technical term, but I do point out that the fact that he had sexual relationships with a 9-year-old girl was not something that was condemned in that society. He was the chief, he was the leader, he could have any woman he want or any child that he wanted, and that was the way that it was. But people would have a different kind of perspective on that today. And some Muslims do too. Some are very ashamed of that, and they want to try and deny that it happened. What do you think caused the change from peaceful to violence? I think opportunity was one. So when he left Mecca, he left as a fugitive. When he arrived in Medina, he was welcomed as a hero. And the people said, "We will fight for you." In fact, he made them promise to fight for him before he even went there. So now he had an army, so he could do that. He had 12 years of revenge that he wanted to pay back on. And so that was the cause of that, I think. And is it true that Islam uses the Old Testament? Muslims accept the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Zabur, the Psalms, as books from God, but they say that they're corrupted. So they're not things that you can follow, that you can necessarily follow now. Now the question is starting to come. Can you worship, confirm that Christianity and Islam worship the same God but through different representatives? I'll talk about that in the second session, so you have to come back for faith effect. I'll give you a response to that one. One more that's come up. Difference between Sunni and Shia. So when Muhammad died, he didn't designate a successor. And so the division came about who should be the leader. One group called the Party of Ali, Shi'at Ali, so that's where Shia comes from, thought that he should be the leader, and others went for Muhammad's best friend, Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr won, although Ali eventually became the leader. Let's just go through how to respond as Christians. Jesus faced physically violent enemies, and we saw that in the passage in Mark. It says they conspired together to kill him. And Jesus was quite honest about that. He didn't pretend it wasn't happening. He says, hasn't Moses given you the law? Why are you trying to kill me? And he said, I know that you're ready to kill me. He was quite honest about that. And I think it's important for us to be honest about Islamic terrorism. It's happening. There's been over 30,000 fatal jihad attacks since 9/11, and happened the other day, and they will continue to happen. I can guarantee tomorrow or today there will be about 4 or 5 violent fatal jihad attacks somewhere around the world. We're not hearing them unless you watch SBS News, or there's a website called Religion of Peace that will give you all the details of that, but it's happening. Here's a pictures of the 40, there's over 40, I've only got about 30 of them there, convicted terrorists, people that have been convicted of terrorism offences here in Australia for conspiring to be involved in terrorist acts. Notice there's not an Anglican amongst them. Every single one of them comes from Islam, and we need to be honest about that. It's a painful thing to talk about, but we do need to talk about it. We can't just pretend that it's not happening. Jesus also had ideological enemies, and again we saw in the passage in there, the scribes and the Pharisees would gang up on him and tackle him about different things, and Jesus pushed back. He didn't run away, he didn't go silent on there. He always gave a response to them. He says to them, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness." He said to them, "You load people down with burdens they can't carry, and you don't lift a finger to help them." And I think it's important for us as Christians to speak out against critics. Yesterday I took my team down to some of the tables that you see in the city from some Muslim groups who are really quite critical about Christianity, and it's important that we learn how to respond to those kind of verbal attacks. Jesus did it, and we need to do it. I each year get involved in a public debate with a Muslim scholar, and you can see some of the topics and some of the people that I faced up against there on a whole range of issues about Muhammad, about the Quran, about issues of Jesus and how he fits in Islamic thinking. I haven't been able to find a debating partner for this year. They haven't done too well in their debates. These are all on YouTube, by the way. If you Google my name and YouTube and debate, you can have a look at these and just see how, as Christians, we've got answers to all of the kind of attacks that Muslims would take, and we've actually got some questions to ask them. Jesus also lived in the context of poverty, and we know these famous words from Matthew 25, "I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, I was a stranger, I needed clothes." Jesus identifying with the poor, and the man with the withered hand who comes into the mosque. This man couldn't work because his hand was with, synagogue, let's go for synagogue. See where I've been spending most of my time. Comes in with his withered hand, and this man couldn't work because of that. And Jesus wants to free this man. It's not just a physical infirmity. It's being able to support your family, being able to work. Jesus responds in grace to those. And when we look at many of the Muslims that have come into Australia have come here as refugees. There's some of the wars that have been about 80% of the world's refugees are Muslim. They're only 24% of the world's population. And so Islam is not working as a system. People are leaving it in great numbers because of war, because of violence, lack of opportunity, corruption, all of these things. I've lived in Muslim countries and I can understand why people would often want to leave those. When they come to Australia, Muslims don't tend to get up to the top of the pile. Some do. So Ahmed Fahour, the head of Australia Post, was the highest paid public servant in Australia. It got even more money than the Prime Minister. Was a Muslim who came to Australia as a young person. And we saw Waleed Ali and others. But most Muslims are down the bottom of the economic pile. 40% of them live in what we call poverty households that are below the poverty level. Their unemployment rate is typically twice that of the Australian unemployment rate. It's not the same for all immigrants. Chinese, for example, have a lower unemployment rate than the Australian unemployment rate. So we've got, it's not to do with race, it's not to do with where they come from, but there's this issue within Islam. And it's important that we respond to Muslims in need. In January, I'm taking a team over to Jordan, and we'll work with Syrian refugees that are coming across the border. We'll be in a town where 100,000 refugees have left everything behind and just come with what they could carry, and we'll be running programs for them. That's full, but I'll be running it again in the future, so if people want to contact me about that. How did Jesus respond to those who wanted to hear? Well, we saw him in that passage. He was in the synagogue on the Sabbath. And Jesus took every opportunity he could to preach. He wanted people to know about the kingdom of God. He wanted them to know who he was. And he berates his disciples. He says, "Don't you say 4 months more and then the harvest? I tell you, open your eyes and look at the fields. They are ripe for harvest." And I think sometimes when Christians and other people think about Islam, it's kind of fear and intimidation, and we think we don't want to even connect with them. And it's important that we do. It's important for their sake that we do. Each Saturday we have a table. Each Saturday we have a table that sets up in the city. In fact, we've got three tables there. Our byline is "Jesus loves Muslims, so do we." We're there to share the good news with Muslim people. And each week, Muslims come along to our table and we get the opportunity to talk with them about Jesus. We're quite open about our identity. We're Christians, it says there, sharing Jesus, engaging with Islam. We've got lots of resources there, so again, you can contact me about those, or you can come drop into the city. We're on Swanson Street on three different locations, and go and collect some of the information from there. How did Jesus respond to those who wanted to follow him? Well, he discipled them. He brought them into his fold. They joined his group, and they marched with him and told others about the good news of Jesus. And we're seeing an amazing response within the Muslim community. More Muslims have come to faith over the last 20 years than in the previous 1,400 years. It's a time of harvest. The countries that are circled there are countries where I have met Muslims who have come to faith. I've even baptised some of them. So we're seeing this. It's quite a consistent thing. All around the world, Muslims are turning to Christ when they have the opportunity to do so. So to summarise, how did Jesus respond to people? He didn't respond the same way. We see there was variety in there. First of all, to those who wanted to kill him, Jesus exposed them. He was quite honest about that. To those who criticised him, Jesus answered them. To those who are in need, Jesus helped them. We never see him turning people away from that. He constantly looked after those who came into his circle. To those who wanted to listen, he taught them. And to those who wanted to follow, Jesus discipled them. But he gave his life for every single one of them. He didn't just die for the people who liked him. He died even for the people who put him on the cross. Father, forgive them, he prayed, because they don't know what they're doing. And there's that compassion that compels us, that should compel us. So bring it into the 21st century. How should we respond to Muslims? Well, there are some who are physical and attacking and violent and oppressive, and we need to expose them. We don't pretend that it's not happening. Let's be honest about it. It is happening, and we need to do everything that we can to make sure that they're not able to carry out their plans, and also to engage their kind of that ideology from an academic perspective. So this is the task of cooperating with police and security forces, and also research and public policy. For those who are critical, we need to respond to them and oppose them, and this is the task of polemics and apologetics. We teach courses at the Melbourne School of Theology on apologetics to Islam. So the questions that your Muslim colleague or neighbour or friend could be asking you, we will give you ways to respond to that from a Christian perspective. To those who are poor, our calling is to help them and to serve them. We've just had a Muslim refugee girl living with us for the last couple of weeks. She came to Australia with no money, nowhere to live. We took her into our house so she could get established to work out what she needed to do next. And it's important that we do that so that people can see the love of Christ. To those who are responsive, our calling is to train them and to teach them. But we operate out of the context of love. And ISLAM stands for I Sincerely Love All Muslims. I think that's so key. Just to finish off, there's a verse in 1 Corinthians 16 which gives us a kind of this nuanced understanding that we need to have. Paul says to the people of Corinth, be on guard, but be firm in the faith. We don't just back off and vacate the public space, the ideological space, the theological space. We go and we stand in there because we have something to say through Jesus. Be courageous, be strong, and do everything in love. There's some more questions there, but I'll answer those in the faith effect time, and I encourage you to come back for that if you can. Thanks very much.